This call is being recorded.
Okay. Then I'm gonna mute everyone. Oops, not that. Participants, information. Hi, everybody. We're gonna get started in just a minute or two. Once I remember how to mute everyone, I'm going to mute everyone, but feel free to unmute yourself if you have a question, or also just to type it to the chat box. The chat box is on the left on the screen. Everyone should be seeing the home screen right now. Okay, I'm going to mute Gina. If you can't unmute, I'll go unmute you. Why don't you try and unmute yourself first? I'm going to mute everyone. All right. Gina, why don't you see if you can unmute yourself? Well, that didn't even seem to mute everyone. Unmute all. Nope. Everyone should be muted. And then.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes. We hear you. That's great. Good. We'll give everyone 1 minute. We'll start maybe 1 minute after. And if anyone's having trouble connecting, just holler, let me know. I'll just check one last time for any emails or any problems. Okay. Hey, everybody, we're going to get started in about 30 seconds. So let me know. Feel free to use the chat window if you're having any problems. Feel free to unmute yourself if you have any questions or anything you'd like to ask. Oh, I should also say, hopefully everyone got the handout. Gina produced a really nice summary handout. It's on the screen there. It's also on 21 Elements website. But it's probably easiest just to click the screen, assuming that hot link works. If it doesn't, go to 21elements.com and it's at the top on the homepage. If you didn't get the handout, she sent a version and then we sent a updated version. So make sure you're using that second one, or if you're not, don't know which one you're using, just follow that link for the handout on the screen or at the 21elements.com meeting section up top. And we'll get started. We're super lucky to have Gina Rada from Gable Energy, the owner of Gable Energy. She is a Title IV consultant, Title 24 consultant, and a energy code guru, a master of ADUs and how the new energy codes affect them. So I'm just gonna turn it over to her.
So thank you for having me. I was asked to kind of talk about ADUs under this current 2019 code cycle and how the code looks at the requirements for ADUs, whether they're new construction or what we like to call additions. We'll talk through that. And then also kind of what's going on with REACH codes and how they may or may not affect ADUs in terms of what your local governments, and you are, I'm assuming the local governments are putting together potentially in terms of REACH codes. So let's go through this. I do have kind of really go through how do we look at ADU buildings from envelope to mechanical. So I can get through this pretty quickly. So let me know. Definitely type any questions you may have. And if there's a slide number, telling me the slide number 2 really helps in me being able to identify where the question might be headed. I am brought to you by Energy Code ACE. Energy Code ACE is paid for by you, the customers, utility customers of California. And I am managed through PG&E, but under the auspices of the California Public Utilities Commission. And I'm hoping if any of you have questions after today, you'll go check out our website at www.energycodeace.com. We have so much that supports not only ADUs, but anything to do with the energy code. I'm hoping if maybe you don't use us, you'll let people know we exist to help them out. My goal for you guys today is to review the different examples of ADU types and how they might be classified and be affected by the energy code, looking at what potential solutions may be in play for ADUs, especially considering REACH codes, And how does the 2019 code look for ADUs, how it might look different than it did last year under the 2016 code? You guys not only have the handout that was on the link, and this is an overview of the different types of ADUs, whether it's conversion from existing conditions or existing structure, versus the second page is all about what's required if that ADU is built from scratch and not attached to any other existing buildings on the property. But what we also have an Energy Code ACE, but that I didn't have in the handout, but I would like it if you guys would go to our website. You can easily find this overview of what's new for the 2019 code. We have one for residential, and we also have one for non-residential, if that might be of interest. So the California energy goals have up to this point been very focused on zero net energy. But with the last couple of years, there's been a shift, and a shift in the in how we're looking at how can the energy code help with the overarching goals that California has. So moving forward, not only is the Energy Commission looking at how can we build in energy efficiency into buildings in a cost-effective manner. Every single energy code requirement has to show that it pays for itself or over its lifetime through cost-effectiveness studies, of which then that's when it becomes an energy code requirement. And then also looking at carbon neutrality and how can that look like in terms of an energy code, trying not to favor one energy source versus another in terms of compliance. Local cities and counties can decide to go further above and beyond what is adopted at the state level through REACH codes. REACH codes do still have to support the energy efficiency of the energy code and has to be approved by the Energy Commission to be enforceable. And there are quite a few cities who are going the route of electrification. So I'm pulling up Berkeley's REACH code ordinance for 2019, only because Berkeley is one of the first ones that put out this handout that's so easy to understand. We are hearing that close to 70 to 90 cities are looking at adopting REACH codes like this. And I see some of the cities on here that are attending are very aware of these REACH codes because you have REACH codes in your own area that either are in play now or about to be in play. But this is an example of a REACH code that is looking at if you're building brand new, so this is new construction only, and you want to use natural gas for your space heating and or space water needs of the home, well, then you're going to have to dive a little bit deeper into energy compliance because we want to help minimize how much natural gas is being used to heat the water and the spaces of those buildings. So we'll see here that for new constructed buildings, for a mixed fuel building, and that's if they're using natural gas for space heating or water heating, they have to have a higher efficiency score. It's what we call an EDR score. I'm going to go through that quickly, what an EDR score is, that it has to be 10 EDR points better, basically, than a building that's all electric. And if it's all electric, meaning we're using heat pump technology for space heating, heat pump technology for water heating, well, then nothing additional is going to be required except for potentially other CalGreen requirements associated with EV charging. So this is just an example of what some cities are adopting. I'm finding that most cities have kind of their own unique formula they're putting into place. So it does kind of sometimes create challenges for us, me as an energy consultant, trying to keep up on what are the different cities adopting and how the construction practices might look differently when I submit for permit. This is a handout that the Energy Commission always comes out with at the beginning of each code cycle. And it kind of gives us an overview of what are the big hitters associated with this energy code cycle. We see here solar photovoltaics. So for new homes and new ADUs from scratch, not attached to any other existing home on the property, PV is required. We'll talk about that and what maybe some exceptions may be in play. Demand response compliance options. This is where the Energy Commission is really looking at alternative ways that we could be managing our grid during the peak of the day when everyone's at work, but their PV systems are working really nice and hard because it's sunny out and they're generating all this electricity. How can we use that electricity that's being generated effectively? They're looking at things such as pre-cooling, where people can choose to have the utilities be able to speak to their thermostats and turn the temperature down on a sunny day and pre-cool the building. So when the homeowner comes home, it's a beautiful 68 degrees and they don't really need to turn on the air conditioner anymore until maybe much later in peak use conditions because of the fact that the home is so incredibly efficient and is not losing much of that cooling that we're doing. So it's really going to be interesting to see how demand response compliance options are going to play at the state level. Healthy indoor air quality. Some people are calling this the IAQ code. Up until this point, many of us were out there saying 2020 is when all new residential construction needs to be zero net energy. Well, they weren't able to achieve that goal because they weren't able to show that for both mixed fuel and all electric, that zero net energy would pay for itself over the lifetime of those building features. So I like to call it as close as we could get to zero net energy, but really honestly, we really did a lot with indoor air quality. So we'll talk through a couple of the big hitters that are going to affect specifically ADUs when we talk about indoor air quality. And like they do with every code cycle, they are making that building efficiency more stringent. So the requirements for walls, for windows, for roofs got a little bit more stringent than it did for the 2016 code cycle. They always put a cost into, hey, what's the initial cost associated with all these features now required by code? We see here a number of $9,500. But then they also put in the big blue numbers there. What is it that they're basing their cost effectiveness on in terms of over a 30-year mortgage that homeowner will save in terms of not paying for additional electricity and or natural gas because of these measures? I always like to look at, well, how much more stringent what this code cycle is from the previous code cycle. And if we roll in building efficiency, solar PV, and some of the other measures that are associated with this code, it is 52% more stringent, or another way of saying this is 52% more energy efficient than the same exact building that would have shown compliance to our previous code cycle. I want to share one of my favorite tools that I use. It's called Reference ACE. This is available through Energy Code ACE. It has all the language of the standards, the actual code language itself. Also includes reference appendices, which for all of us who are in the industry, it's really important we understand what's in the reference appendices. Might not be such of a big deal to all of you who are attending the session today. Also, any of the manuals are written in full sentences and pretty pictures to support the information that is outlined on the standards within the standards language itself, which is the legal language. We have some additional tools that us energy consultants use a lot. Our ACMs are the rules behind the software. Everything is hyperlinked. Everything is sortable. You can do favorites. You can search and bookmark. This to me is just one of the best tools that's out there to help us as an industry. I also wanted to make sure all of you are aware of the fact that the next code cycle is being developed right now. A lot of people are like, oh, whoa, Gina, I just got this code cycle under my belt. It's still feeling really uncomfortable, and now you want to talk about the next code cycle. But between now and about June is here where we'll see the CEC pre-rulemaking. That's when the ability to have a say, to be able to voice any concerns and or encouragement to what's being developed for the 2022 code cycle, which will go into place January 1st of 2023, now is the time to have a say. So I just really want to put it out there, if any of you are really interested and passionate about code development and what may or may not should be included in the next code cycle, please get involved now, because now's the time. So what is an ADU? And sometimes I go into a room and people totally know when I say ADU, they're like, oh, you mean in-law unit, or granny unit is another word that people have used. And, you know, it's an accessory dwelling unit. And as all of you know, there's been a lot of attention at the state of California regarding ADUs to help alleviate our housing crisis. And there has been a series of Senate bills and assembly bills and even more coming about making it easier for people to build and or incorporate an ADU unit or more. I find usually most homeowners just do one to their existing property. I was asked to by Joshua to talk a little bit about AB 2044. That is an assembly bill that's being proposed. It has not been voted upon. It has not passed at all. So I don't want anyone to think this is in place. But AB 2044 is about providing a little bit more flexibility for brand new ADUs in which they're saying the PV requirements of this 2019 energy code would not be required for brand new ADUs. Now, again, that's not voted upon yet. I do not know what the results of that are going to be, but potentially we're going to be seeing even more flexibility potentially be provided to cities and being able to encourage maybe a less expensive install associated with ADUs on existing properties. So I'd like to talk about the challenges that we usually face when we talk to our clients about getting an ADU on their property. Usually when people have an ADU, it's a small footprint, but they want it to feel welcoming and they want to have a lot of natural light. And, you know, we don't want it to fit, look and feel like a shed. And so they have a tendency to want a little bit more window area or glass than the energy code really truly supports, because window area is dependent upon the conditioned floor area of a space. How big is it? Not all mechanical options are practical for an ADU. If you have a furnace in your house and maybe an air conditioner, pretty much the smallest size you can get those in starts about 2 tons or, 80,000 BTU of heating. That is way too much when you consider how small these ADUs are. So we have a little bit of a limitation in terms of finding right size equipment and the type of equipment that the Energy Commission supports that can be used for ADUs, and we'll talk about this just a little bit when we move forward. Bringing a natural gas line to the back of a property can be cost prohibitive. And not just that, we're finding that it's taking months for people to be getting on the list to have even someone come out and trench to bring that gas line back to that property, to the ADU that might be in the back of the home. So there's a lot of difficulties in being able to bring natural gas to an ADU, let alone even if the city is going to allow them to, in terms of their electrification reach codes. So with this particular code cycle, the 2019 code cycle, the Energy Commission alleviated and kind of got rid of all the barriers that were in play that made it very difficult for us to show compliance for all electric dwelling units, such as an ADU or a brand new single family home. So that's really exciting, and we'll take a look at what that is. We're usually really up tight and close to property lines. And a lot of those assembly and Senate bills were all about providing flexibility of how close you can be to property lines. But we have some pretty stringent insulation requirements for ADUs, including consideration for putting insulation outside the framing of the walls, making it even closer to the property lines. And that could be something that's not even viable for these projects. Property height restrictions. We have pretty beefy insulation requirements for the roof that might make that roof be a little bit taller than what is allowed by local code. And then the cost, and we talked a little bit about that with bringing that natural gas line to the back of the property, wanting to have something that's affordable to build, but not so much that they're, you kind of feel like you're selling your children to build an ADU. But, how much these cost is definitely an issue. And a lot of people are saying it's the energy code that's dictating the cost. We'll see what that looks like. So when we think about the energy code, we have to think about how the energy code looks at a hierarchy of what's allowed. So mandatory measures are the first building block of the energy code. And these are measures that have to be done all the time, anywhere, everywhere in California. These are things we have like minimum insulation requirements. A 2x4 wall cannot use an R value any less than R13. That's a mandatory minimum. But then we have layered on top of mandatory measures, and this is always what confuses people about the energy code, we have prescriptive requirements. Now, prescriptive requirements are based on climate zone. What's cost effective in your climate zone might not be cost effective for the climate zone on the other side of California. It's also based on cost effectiveness of project scope. The requirements for a brand new building, the most cost-effective time to integrate energy efficiency measures when you're designing and building for the first time, versus additions and alterations in which, we have existing infrastructure, and it's not so cost-effective anymore to require some of these requirements that the energy code looks at for new construction. I can use the performance approach, and this is where I'm doing a virtual simulation of how my building at that exact location is using energy over the course of a year. And I can trade prescriptive measures. I don't want the rigid insulation on the walls, because I got to tell you, the prescriptive requirements for new walls is that 2x4 wall with R13 and 2 inches of rigid insulation outside of the framing. We really honestly find no one is willing to go about and build that type of wall. People are using the performance approach to trade away those 2 inches of rigid insulation towards another equal energy efficient measure of the ADU, such as higher efficiency mechanical equipment. There's so many other things we could be doing trade-offs for just to get flexibility of being able to build that wall all the way down to that mandatory minimum of 2x4 with R13 between the framing. So that's just an example of how flexibility is looked at and how mandatory versus prescriptive goes into play. We have 16 climate zones in the state of California. The majority of California is what we call an extreme climate zone, meaning they're using a lot of air conditioning because it's hot, or they're using a lot of heating energy because it's really cold, like such as Tahoe, and we've got snow. But we do have our coastal regions in California that really keep a more moderate temperature. And so things that might be cost effective, let's say here in the desert of climate zone 15, is definitely not what's going to be shown to be cost effective here in the Bay Area, which is climate zone 3. And all of that is taken into consideration as they develop the prescriptive requirements associated with the energy code. So I'm going to dive into the 4 different types of ADUs. If anyone has any questions or concerns or comments, do feel free to write it in the chat. Even if it's, hey, I'd like to say something and I'm going to unmute myself. Do feel free to be part of the conversation. I kind of don't want to think I'm saying this super, super fast and leaving all of you behind. So let me know when you want me to pause a bit. And let's walk through my 4 different types of ADUs as defined by the Energy Commission. So an accessory dwelling unit can be built 2 different ways. I can be doing new construction, meaning I'm building it from scratch. There was never anything there before. And that's going to remember the most cost-effective time to integrate energy efficiency measures is when I'm designing and building it for the first time. The requirements for an ADU that's considered new construction are a lot more stringent than accessory dwelling units considered additions. In the last code cycle was, I think it was 2018, the Energy Commission came out with a clarification about how the code looks at ADUs, and that if you're converting existing space, let's say it's a shed, let's say it's a 2-car garage, and you're going to convert that to an ADU, you are not considered new construction. This was relatively new because before 2018, that was considered new construction. But to try and make things be more flexible for ADUs, they said, you know, if you're going to convert existing space, the garage, a basement, a shed, and you even add on to it, I'm going to double the size of the shed, that's considered an addition. And there's a lot more flexibility and less things are required for additions because it's not considered new construction. So that was pretty revolutionary when we're thinking about how do we look at these ADUs. So here I have an example of there was existing unconditioned storage associated with this home. These are real projects, by the way, in the Bay Area. And they converted that crawl space, they kind of dug it out, made it everything in terms of habitable, and turned it into an ADU. Because it is existing structure, and they converted it to an ADU, and it's attached to the existing home, this is considered an addition and gets all the flexibility measures associated with additions in our code. Here's an example of a home that had a nice little courtyard, I gotta say, in their backyard. I'm kind of sad they don't have that courtyard anymore. And they converted that open space behind their garage to, they added on new construction, an ADU. But because this ADU is attached to the existing home, this is not considered new construction. This is considered an addition and is subject to all the flexibility measures we have associated with additions. Now, let's say we have this 1.5 car garage. I convert that to an ADU. That is also considered an addition because whereas no, it was not attached to the existing home, I'm converting an existing structure to this habitable accessory dwelling unit, and I get all the flexibility associated with additions. So new building is I'm building from scratch. It's not attached to the existing home at all. Well, now the full flavor of the energy code is going to apply to this building. So here, this is the backyard again, but instead of it being attached, see how they have this walkway separating this ADU from the main house? That now, because it's not attached to the existing structures at all, nor was it converted from an existing structure, is going to be considered a new residential building and will have to meet the energy code in its entirety. So let's take a look at this. What is going to be required for one versus the other? And this is where we get a little technical, so I'm going to have a light touch to this and hope that I don't lose some of you. Make sure you let me know if you want me to dive a little bit deeper. So here I have that example of they are turning part of their crawl space and they're digging it out and they're going to turn it into an ADU. All of those walls are not considered new walls and have to meet, remember I said 2x4 with 2 inches of rigid? They only have to fill the cavity with insulation and we walk away and call it done. We're taking into consideration there might be lot line considerations. We're lining up walls with existing walls. We don't want things to look different. So that is that flexibility that's in play. Lindy is asking, do the additions still need to meet the requirements of FEMA to be above base flood elevation? Definitely. I do not know of any ADU exceptions associated with FEMA at all. I got to tell you, this was not in the floodplain. I immediately know what part of the Bay Area you live in. Are you talking about the above base flood elevation? You're in one of the lower areas, not one of the higher areas. And this particular project was in a higher area in the Bay Area. You're a window area, because window is where I have the most energy transfer happening. I have a lot of heat coming in from those windows when the sun is hitting them. I'm losing a lot of heat through these windows in the wintertime because, well, it's not ever going to be as good as an insulated wall. And so I have some limitations on how much window I'm allowed to have. And we have some QII requirements, quality insulation, installation, that may apply, and I'll talk a little bit about the flavor of that. David is saying new state code clarifies that demolition of an existing detached garage and replacement with a new building within the same footprint is considered a conversion. How would that be considered in regards to the energy code? That is a great question because that has come up actually, David, on a few of our projects. And we have had to ask the local building department, are you going to consider this a new residential building? Or are you going to be considering this a conversion? Because we're using the same exact footprint, but of course, who wants to retain any materials that are not safe to use anymore? So the energy code basically says whatever the building department is going to consider it, if they're going to say it's new construction, it has to meet full all the energy code requirements as new construction. If the building department is going to say it's a conversion and it's an alteration or an addition, great. The energy code will consider that way too. The energy code leaves the door open saying the local authority having jurisdiction is who's going to define how the energy code is applied. So in this, that particular scenario, I'd be contacting the local building department, asking them, hey, what are you guys going to call this? Because it affects how I'm going to be looking at it in terms of energy code compliance. Here we have that scenario where I'm attaching the ADU. It's brand new construction, but I am attaching it to the existing home. All of these walls that I call them extended, and I thought I had a little thing there and I didn't, oops. Extended walls, that's where I'm extending from the existing plane, and you can't see my hands as I'm motioning this right now. That's walls that are extending out from an existing wall get to have the same allowances a converted wall has, such as if it's 2x4 here in the existing home, they get to use 2x4 as the wall depth for those new walls. No rigid insulation is going to be required for that wall. We just need to fill the cavity with insulation. So that is a nice flexibility in being able to adapt and incorporate existing construction for these ADUs. when I am converting a space, and this is an, kind of a flavor what David was saying, I have 2x4 walls. I get to keep those 2x4 walls. I do not have to add the rigid insulation. I just need to fill the walls with insulation. So a lot of flexibility. Here's an example of it. It was a much smaller kind of, let's say it was a shed to begin with. And I need to add to it. So this back part here, the kitchen and the bathroom, is new construction, an addition being added to a converted unconditioned storage shed. These are both considered additions and both get the flexibility associated with additions under the energy code. Let's talk about what some of those just kind of overall insulation measures are. I don't expect you, I'm not going to test any of you on these requirements after we leave today, but it might just feel comfortable you knowing what they are. If my ADU that's considered an addition, converted space, I'm adding on from the existing home, et cetera, my roof only needs to have R30 in climate zones 2 through 10, which is most of the Bay Area. And it's going to then be R38 in my colder or more or hotter climate zones, climate zone 1, that's Eureka area, and 11 through 16, that's like Lafayette, over the hill a little bit where it's hotter, Dublin, Pleasanton, et cetera. The minute that ADU is over 700 square feet, then the full breadth of the code is going to apply to that now pretty big accessory dwelling unit being converted from existing space. And now we've tipped the balance in which making sure that the energy savings associated with new construction will apply to these larger converted ADUs. There's some stuff about cool roof and radiant barrier. I'm not really going to get there, into that with you guys. Now, our roofs are really unique. So it's what we call a high-performance attic. I do want to say these high-performance attic requirements do not apply to climate zones 2 and 3 here in the Bay Area. Climate zone 2 is Sonoma County, and climate zone 3 is definitely the Bay Area. It stops right at the hills. We go over the hill to San Ramon, that's a different climate zone. Now, over the hill to Lafayette, that's a different climate zone. But most of the East Bay and the San Francisco Peninsula is climate zone 3. Outside of those climate zones, I have these requirements about high performance attic. And what makes it high performance is there's insulation in two places, insulation at the ceiling. I have a vented attic, so this is not a cathedral ceiling at all. And I have insulation below the roof deck. Now, I guess I'm hoping you can imagine how this might add height to a building to be able to configure and build an attic that can support this. And that's where those height issues might be a concern when we're talking about larger additions, larger ADUs over 700 square feet or ADUs from scratch, brand new. Walls. If walls exist already, those are considered what we call extended walls, meaning fill the cavity with insulation, walk away, call it done. New walls are walls that are not extending from an existing wall, nor are they being built from scratch. My walls that I'm converting, 2x4 wall, I have to use R15. Now that's different than R13, which was that mandatory minimum that I talked about earlier. R15 is a condensed bat that fits into that 3.5-inch cavity. It costs more money. We usually need to have more lead time to get it. It's something that can cause some difficulties for people out in the field regarding R15. If it's a 2x6 wall within that 5.5-inch cavity, I can't use R19. I can't even use a blow-on R20. I have to use a condensed bat R21. So even though I'm allowing, the energy code is allowing flexibility for these existing and or extended walls, they still want to have high R value associated with that assembly. This is what I have to consider for those walls that are not converted and or extended from existing walls. I have a mandatory minimum, so we talked about that already, that 2x4 wall, I have to have at least R13. In my mild climate zones, these are super, super, super mild climate zones. This is 6 and 7. This is San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara area. That 2x4 wall is actually then only needing 1.5 inches of rigid. But here in our climate zone, that's climate zones 2, 3, and 4 in this area, we have a U factor that represents, here's that 2x4 wall I was talking about with the 2 inches of rigid insulation outside the framing to be able to achieve this U factor. I could potentially do it other ways, such as using spray-in insulation. I've even had some people go, oh, we're going to use that new gel stuff. I'm like, yeah, when you sell your kids, you can't, because that stuff's expensive. But there's different ways I can consider how I get these U factors, because I'm not just talking R values anymore like I do for extended walls. So here's an example of an extended wall where I have the existing wall here from the two bedrooms, and it's going out and serving that ADU. It's an extended wall. I get to use the 2x4. I have to use R15 in that wall. I don't get to use R13, the mandatory minimum, but I do get to use R15 and not think about the rigid. Now, fenestration is all about how much window do I get. The smaller the ADU, and here I'm saying additions, because remember, those converted ADUs are considered additions. You'll see the smaller it is, I actually get a little bit more glass, because the Energy Commission's realizing with a small footprint, you still need to meet egress requirements. You still need to meet natural ventilation requirements. You still need to meet natural daylighting requirements. But the larger the ADU gets, the more stringent the energy code is going to be looking at those windows. And what we really look at is, what's the performance of the windows, the U factor. U factor is heat transferring through the window. A single pane window is going to transfer a heck of a lot more heat than a dual paned window. But it's also about the framing. A metal framed window is going to transfer a heck of a lot of heat versus a window that has a thermal break, such as vinyl, such as wood. Those are typically more expensive. So these windows are really efficient. This U factor 0.3 is a very, very efficient window. And then we have a solar heat gain coefficient requirement, not in climate zone 3, but we do down in the south part of the Bay Area in climate zone 4. Because this is all about the sun is hitting those windows. How are we preventing heat gain from heating up the ADU, in which now we have to use air conditioning to cool the space down? This number represents a very efficient piece of glass, because it's all about the glass. So windows, I have to tell you, I find are the most expensive item, people, that one most expensive item, except for maybe PV. And people want a lot more flexibility with window performance than is allowed by the code. It definitely is a major discussion. New to this code cycle, we have now rating requirements for solid doors. We never had these requirements before. But basically, the code is saying that front door, if it's solid, we want it to be an insulated door to meet the energy code. And this can cause issues if it's a custom door. They have to go with that performance alternative method to get flexibility away from the insulated door requirements of this new 2019 code cycle, because they want to have something that's not insulated. I'm not saying it's not allowed, but I'm saying it's difficult. I'm converting a space. I get this all the time. Gina, we're converting our 1910, basement, because they do exist in a few of the homes in the Bay Area. And I have amazing wood pane, single pane glass. Can I keep the windows? And I basically have to say no, because we have U factor requirements that if you can't meet these U factor requirements, mandatory U factor requirements, it's not allowed. And a single paned window is not going to meet these requirements. So even though that window exists already, because I'm converting this existing space to a conditioned space, an ADU, it has to meet the performance window requirements of the code. This is something they did not provide wiggle room on, because windows can definitely have a big swing in terms of energy efficiency. HVAC, indoor air quality, and domestic hot water. This is when I know I get into the weeds a bit, but this is really important when we talk about electrification. This is really important when we talk about indoor air quality. So Joshua is asking, what about historic windows? Excellent question. For historic buildings that are certified historic, their existing facades are 100% exempt to the energy code. Their mechanical systems are not going to be exempt, but anything they have, like those beautiful wavy single pane wood stopped windows, do not have to be replaced, because they are considered a historic feature of a certified historic building. So historic buildings get a lot of exceptions. I do get a lot of questions, though. Someone added on to their historic building, they're like, I'm adding on to my historic building. It has to look the same. I'm like, I'm sorry, the energy code does not give you exception for new construction that you're adding on to a historic building. And that's where things get a little sticky. So when we talk about our heating, ventilating, and air conditioning systems, this is more in play if I'm converting an existing space in the building, let's say an attached garage and so forth. And people are like, you know, I'm just going to tap into the heating and cooling system I have already. So I'm going to bring a duct over there and dump it into this ADU. That's not allowed by the residential code or the mechanical code. The mechanical code says that each dwelling unit cannot share return air. And so you can't dump a duct from a ducted system into another dwelling unit and not share return air. It's just not possible. Now, if I have completely two different ducted systems, great, because I'm not sharing return air. Let's say it's not ducted. It's a hydronic system, and I'm going to have their own temperature or thermostat in their area versus mine. That totally works because you're not sharing return air because it's not a ducted system. So it's just things we need to be aware of. How are you going to heat the space? Because the residential code requires any habitable space has to maintain 68 degrees Fahrenheit, 3 feet above the floor, on the coldest day of the year. The other change that happened in this particular code cycle, the 2019 code cycle, remember, is the indoor air quality code cycle, is that each dwelling unit, I don't care how big or small it is, has to have its own indoor air quality ventilation system. Previous code cycles allowed some exceptions for spaces less than 1,000 square feet, but that was never the intent of the code. The intent of the code is to make sure each dwelling unit has good quality indoor air. So every new dwelling unit, I don't care how small, I don't care how big, will have to have its own indoor air quality system. Associated with indoor air quality is kitchen hoods. Kitchen hoods now have requirements that they have to be meet a certain CFM or airflow value, cooling enough air out of there to be healthy. But then also they have to be 3 zones or less. That's how quiet they are. They want them to be quiet fans because they're finding that because most kitchen hoods are so loud, mine, the whole house sounds like it's shaking and it's going to take off in an airfield. People aren't turning on their kitchen hoods. So these new requirements for kitchen hoods, which apply to any kitchen hood, by the way, that's being replaced and or associated with a new home or a new ADU, will have to be certified through a registry that it is quiet and meets the airflow, and that's going to be verified by a third-party inspector that we call a HERS rater. So this is the part that's exciting to this code cycle. Last code cycle, any dwelling unit was expected to have a tankless gas water heater. And if you did anything else, let's say a tank water heater, or you weren't going to do gas, you were going to do heat pump technology, you took a pretty big hit. It was almost unsurmountable in terms of what you had to do to offset the penalty of not using a gas tankless water heater. In the 2019 code, a NEA 3 rated heat pump water heater, I want to make sure that everyone knows I'm not saying electric resistance. I am not saying electric resistance. I am saying heat pump technology. Heat pump technology, and I'm saying that over and over again because we've had issues with this. And heat pump is basic, you know, that air conditioner unit that's outside your house if you guys have air conditioning. They put that and they attach it to a tank, and it actually works in heat rejection mode. It's collecting heat from the air and converting it. I was wondering how I can do that. Thank you, Alice. That was driving me crazy and I didn't know what to do. So thank you. It converts the heat from the air that it's collecting into that hot water. So it's an extremely efficient way of using electricity to generate heat. In this case, the heat pump is being used as a water heater. We've had technology for heat pump space heating for many, many years now. Europe has been using it for decades. And so our heating technology world is really, honestly, is doing okay in understanding heat pump technology. Heat pump technology for water heating is relatively unique and rare, and it's scaring a little people, but it's a way of doing electrification in a way that leaves behind building efficiency. And the people who are paying those energy bills are not going to be paying outrageous electricity bills because of electrification. because I did say this was the indoor air quality code cycle, I really want to touch on a little bit these new MERV 13 filter requirements. Previous code cycles, it was MERV 6, and this code cycle across the board, non-residential, residential, et cetera, boom, MERV 13. There are, many of you are probably aware of areas in the Bay Area that if you're within a certain distance of a freeway, we needed to have MERV 13. So it's about, hey, there's some kind of scary air quality around the freeway. We want to have better indoor air. The state of California decided that that was what should be appropriate for all new construction, all new HVAC systems, and all HVAC changeouts in which they're changing all the ducting. Well, then these MERV 13 filters are going to apply. I know there's a lot of like words and numbers here, but basically we're saying the airflow, how much air needs to be moving in and out of a home, is double the amount of airflow that it was in the 2016 code cycle just a couple of months ago. So we really are improving what is that indoor air quality, and here's that kitchen hood requirement again. That kitchen hood is all about making sure people turn on their kitchen hoods because they're nice and quiet and they have an airflow high enough of which it's pooling out scary stuff. Mini ductless splits have been a very, very popular way to heat and cool ADUs because they can get all the way down to a half a ton. Remember I said earlier, our standard gas furnace with an air conditioner in the backyard, it starts, the lowest, smallest one is 2 tons. These get all the way down to a half a ton, and they're quite beautiful. We've had some difficulties in being able to say to the Energy Commission, these are really, really efficient. So for the last 10 years, they've been doing this study. They've been studying these out in this home and multiple homes in Stockton. And they went, you know, you're right. These are pretty efficient. So very, very soon, I think it's going to happen in 4 weeks, we're going to be able to take credit or advantage of a mini ductless split system, which is the most beautiful way, in my opinion, to inexpensively, because these are not expensive systems at all, to heat and cool an ADU. It's electric, it's not gas, it helps maintain cities that want to do electrification and homeowners that want to support electrification and use their PV systems more. So I got to tell you, I'm pretty excited about this. There are some rules about every habitable room over 150 square feet has to have its own indoor unit. You can't get one and undercut all the doors and do these grills and have, oh yeah, it works in every room. No, it doesn't. So, I mean, there are some specifications associated with this type of equipment. It will be verified by that third party HERS rater, but I'm so excited. And this is going to be something I can use towards getting flexibility towards that wall insulation and make things a lot easier for my ADUs. Let's talk about what's different from an ADU that's built from scratch, not attached to anything on the existing property. Now, every single thing that applies to a new single family home is going to apply to this ADU. I don't care. It's only 175 square feet. And this is what a lot of people are having some angst with, because it really does add some cost associated with these ADUs being built from scratch. So here's that example of that home where they were putting it, they were not attaching it all to the existing home in the back of the property. Now we really have to look at all these walls as meeting that 2x4 with 2 inches of rigid or trading it, looking at the amount of window and how good are the windows performing, looking at their indoor air quality, looking at their heating and cooling systems and their water heating systems, but we're also looking at PV. So brand new residential buildings in the 2019 code cycle, we're measuring EDR, energy design rating, because we have a score now. A score of 100 represents the worst building that California never allowed to be built. And 0 represents a building that has as much on-site renewable energy as it is using throughout the course of the year. The score that's dictated by the energy code is around 20 or 30, depends on square footage, depends on climate zone. Now, do you remember way back about 45 minutes ago, I talked about Berkeley's REACH code that said you had to have an EDR score or margin, and I don't know why I have this in here twice, I apologize, an EDR margin of 10. So let's take a look at what that means and when it's triggered. I have two buckets associated with EDR building efficiency, that those insulated walls, the roof, the windows, the HVAC systems. The second bucket is photovoltaics and or battery if they so desire. Battery is not required in this code cycle, but it is strongly encouraged because it will help us regulate and kind of deal with peak use conditions of PV generation in the middle of the day and offset evening use by allowing homeowners to use their own stored energy before they start using electricity that's pulled off the grid. So they have to show compliance to not only building efficiency, which we've been doing for the last, the Energy Code started in 1978. This is what we've been doing since 1978. And this is what's brand new to this code cycle, our PV requirements. So I'm always compared, this is a performance calculation, and it might be gobbledygook for you guys, but I want to show you a couple of numbers. I always have a standard building, the perfect building the Energy Code is comparing me to every time I do my performance calculation. That's the 2x4 with 2 inches of rigid, the perfect windows, minimum efficiency mechanical systems. My proposed design is that simulation throughout the entire year of exactly how my design or my architect's design is matching matching up to what I'm being compared to. And this particular project, the building efficiency is 3.3 EDR points better than what's required by code. Then I have my PV requirements. I'm required for this building to have at least 2.54 kW of PV. They're putting in 3. I got to tell you, oversizing your PV system will not give you more building efficiency. That is not going to be a trade-off that's allowed. But it is affecting my total EDR number. And in Berkeley, if I use natural gas heating and or water heating, my EDR margin has to be 10. So if this project is using natural gas heating or natural gas water heating, they are not going to be allowed to build in Berkeley, as an example, because I don't have an EDR margin of 10. I have to do better. If I was using all electric heat pump space heating, heat pump water heating, then I got to tell you, as long as my margin is better than zero, meaning I'm meeting the minimum, and I don't care how much better you are, boom, I'm done. So this is an example of how all electric, as long as you meet state code, you're done. But in Berkeley, if you have natural gas space heating and water heating and or water heating, you have to have a score or margin of 10 EDR better than that same building if it was all electric. I'm hoping that makes sense. I have that high performance attic requirements for the roof. Not so much an issue here in climate zone 3, but it definitely is something that's going to be required in climate zone 4, which is the San Jose, Santa Clara area. Walls, that high performance wall that I was talking about with that 2x4 with 2 inches of rigid insulation. The windows, it's all about what's the performance of those windows. And remember that U factor 0.3 and the SHGC of 0.23 is definitely more stringent than it was in the last code cycle. I do, though, get to take advantage of the fact that I get to use heat pump technology with no penalty whatsoever. Fantastic. I can use a heat pump water heater, a NEA 3 rated heat pump water heater. I can use heat pump heating. And I'm doing great. I might even actually be taking a little bit of credit because I'm using that technology, but I am going to have to do PV. My PV allowance is based on climate zone. So I have my 16 climate zones here. Then I multiply a number of times my conditioned floor area, because the bigger the building, the more PV I need. So these ADUs that are pretty small, they don't need much. It's actually so small, maybe an issue with PV contractors. And then I multiply that PV requirement times how many dwelling units I have. These are brand new dwelling units, by the way, not existing. So I'm adding an ADU to an existing single family property. My dwelling unit count is 1 because I only have 1 brand new dwelling unit. A lot of people ask me, well, are there any exceptions associated with the code? First of all, let's do this example. And let me see if I did it. So I did a 300 square foot ADU, and I'm finding that's about standard these days, about an average of what ADUs are that we work on in our office. Here in climate zone 4, which that's the San Jose area, and I put it through the formula, 1.39 kW, that's about four panels, depending upon the PV system being chosen. It's not big at all. And I could put that PV system wherever I want. It can be on the roof of the ADU, but it can also be on the roof of the existing home. If the existing home has PV, I can, as long as I add 1.39 kW to my existing system, well, that's another way that I'm providing the PV associated with this energy code. There's only one exception associated with PV, and that's because I don't have at least 80 contiguous square feet of roof, which might be the, you know, that might be valid with these small ADUs that have at least 70% of the year the sun is hitting that 80 square feet or greater of roof. And this could be because I have a lot of trees. It could be, I thought I had a picture there. So if I have a bunch of trees, we don't want to tear down trees to save the planet. So if I have my roof of my ADU is just so shaded because of trees, because of other two or three story buildings surrounding the ADU, because of a huge hill or topography, well, then PV is not going to be required because it cannot meet the promise of the energy savings associated with the energy code, because it just isn't going to generate enough electricity to pay for itself. My new ADUs and ADUs that exceed 700 square feet, if they are altered from existing construction, do have to think about QII. So QII is when that third-party HERS rater is going out throughout the construction practice and making sure all the insulation and the air barrier are meeting minimum requirements regarding install. My concern with this is very, very few people are up to speed on what is needed to be successful with QII, so I am nervous about people being able to pass this. Alice is asking, for new ADU buildings, are they required to have PV? If it is a brand new, spanking new ADU building not attached to the existing home at all, yes, unless I'm able to show that I don't have at least 80 contiguous square feet of roof that's not shaded more than 70% of the year. So yes, that is what I'm hearing. A lot of people are just like, oh my gosh, ADUs need PV. There is that one type of ADU, brand new, from scratch, not attached to the existing home, that PV needs to be considered. QII, I just really want to emphasize my concerns about all the inspection times associated with QII and the ability for people to be able to achieve that. After today, if you want to know more, I got to tell you, a lot of the cities, and you guys probably know this yourself, have put together amazing resources about what's going on with ADUs in their city and how to go about designing and getting your permit for ADUs. I just think that they're fantastic. KBEC, California Association of Building Energy Consultants, had Chris Olvera out. He's the head of their outreach department at the Energy Commission, and did a webinar on how to deal with ADUs, and that's available as a recording. I mean, that's available for free as a recording on their website. Energy Code ACE, if any of you are interested in knowing more about the nuts and bolts behind how to model ADUs, we have a recording of a session that is all about how to model to ADUs. And that is my presentation. Caleb is saying, I seem to recall someone once telling me, I always like that, once way back in time, someone told me that the fire code requires a certain amount of clear roof area for fire access. Do you know if this is the case or it affects that continuous square feet requirement? And it depends on the height of the building. And it depends really on location too. There are some fire code requirements regarding fire access and egress. I typically find they're associated more with taller buildings. And I gotta tell you, the energy code doesn't take that into consideration. It says, okay, fine, you can't put the PV on your roof, on the roof, you can put the PV somewhere else. So because I need that roof for fire access is not a written down acceptable exception for PV and trying to figure out if I have that 80 contiguous square feet. Alice is asking if it's possible to get a copy of the slide. I'm assuming you mean slides. The handout I gave you goes over everything I went with you in a two-page nice simple handout. But if you still want my slides, I will send Joshua a PDF copy of that so that he can make it accessible for you on his website. Joshua, is there anything else that you have any other questions? Here's Joshua saying other
questions. I have a few, and then I have an announcement. Well, I'll just do my announcements now. So we have ADU Happy Hour every Monday where people can get their questions answered about the new laws. So join us at 3. We are looking to have another webinar probably in April with HCD to offer interpretations about fire codes and building codes and how they apply to ADUs. And for those who are involved in 21 Elements, we're having our next meeting in a couple weeks. If you want to stay involved or stay aware of the stuff we're doing, just send me an email and I will add you to the 21 Elements email list. Yeah, I had a couple other questions. We'll get the slides. We'll put them up on the 21 Elements website as well. Can you just offer your thoughts about reach codes? Are they good? Are they going too far? How do cities make them so they don't infringe upon ADU production?
Well, I think that there are some cities that have specific reach code requirements that might be onerous to an ADU. And so cities are saying any ADUs, new ADUs on existing property are exempt from these reach code requirements. So there are some cities that are taking that into consideration in terms of the type of construction they see in their area. But honestly, electrification is where people were going already with ADUs. It's just the 2016 code cycle, because of the water heating issue, didn't support electrification of an ADU. This code cycle, it does. And it's all about getting that natural gas line to the back of the property. So I don't think any of the requirements of the code are onerous to ADU in terms of electrification. Where I get most of my pushback is the insulation requirements of the energy code, and the PV requirements of the energy code is usually where I get pushback.
Okay. I had a couple other questions. I'll just ask them too. Do the rules apply the same to junior ADUs, where you're just splitting off a bedroom with a, like, efficiency kitchen and stuff?
The rules don't change at all for the building or for the energy code. If it's a junior ADU or a regular ADU, an ADU is an ADU. It's just less likely that you're going to have a junior ADU that's built from scratch that might trigger the whole full force of the code. I find most junior ADUs are changing out a living room or maybe part of that garage. I don't find they're ever, in my, just in all the ones I've done, I haven't seen them be a brand new, separate, detached building from scratch.
No, they're right. They're not allowed to be. Otherwise, you've never seen them do that. But the heating, so you couldn't, for a junior ADU, just tap onto the main heating system?
No, you're not. Okay. And you don't want to. You really don't. And there's going to be, I really do think if they want to go like with hydronic, electric resistance strip heat is not supported at all by the energy code. But I got to tell you, if you want to sink natural gas, a wall furnace is going to be an appropriate choice. If we want to go electrification, those mini ductless split systems are a thing of beauty, and they're not that expensive, and they're nice and small.
Okay, and then I had one final question. I've heard some talk about maybe making an agreement just to buy 100% solar with the utility provider as an alternative to having on-site solar. Have you heard this? Do you have thoughts about that?
So the intent of the energy code is that the PV system be associated with the utility bill of the property. So if they want PV installed on the property, whether it's bought or leased, because those are the two ways you can go about it if the PV is actually installed on the property. But they did put in provisions for community solar. And but the community solar system is one that it's not attached or on the property, but it's has its chunk of PV, that 1.56 kW, is part of this community solar system. And then they get the benefit of that kW being generated at their solar, their chunk, their little property of that PV system way off who knows where, and it shows up on their bill. And what's interesting about this is that SMUD just got approved as a community solar system. And this was all very fascinating for us who've been following this. And they had to really come up with a program that said, okay, we're going to let you be part of our community solar system. But what they also had to do is, what is the kW chunk promised for this PV system for this brand new ADU, and it has to show up on their utility bill as a credit. They could not be charged for this PV. They had to get credit for the PV. And I think I do know, as a matter of fact, that all the other utilities were looking very carefully at what SMUD was doing and are coming up with their programs, and they're aggressively going to come out with those very soon to get approved by the Energy Commission.
There's another question there.
Okay, Lindy's asking, when going from a duplex R3 and adding an ADU, does that change the occupancy type to R2? And then what is the requirements for the energy code? So the energy code is pretty much the same for R2 and R3. We just look at if it is considered a multifamily structure or not. I got to tell you that a triplex is considered multifamily. But that doesn't mean, but if it's three habitable stories or less, the requirements I just talked about are going to be exactly the same. This is an addition. You don't have the PV requirements. You have all that flexibility regarding the walls, et cetera, and so forth, because of the fact that you're adding on to an existing residential building. I don't care if it's R2. I don't care if it's R3.
Great. We'll do one last call for questions, and then we'll have the slides. And if anyone wants a recording, I can send them out. I could link to that also. Last opportunity for questions. I do want a recording. Okay, we'll have that. I'll put that when I put all the material up on the 21 Elements website. I will add a recording so we can listen to it again and again, because it was so excellent. Thank you, Gina. We appreciate your time and your expertise. And with that, thanks to everyone who participated, and we will talk to you again soon. Have a good day.
Thank you. Have a great Friday.